It's fair to say that any president who won four terms, in fact the only one to do so, is going to be the subject of a lot of books. So it is with Franklin Delano Roosevelt. FDR has been dead for 71 years, but his memory is kept fresh by historians and their works. Beyond his wife, Eleanor Roosevelt, the field of focus around FDR dims a bit. Our guest this hour expands that focus, taking in FDR's private secretary and friend, Marguerite Missy LeHand. She is the subject of the new book, The Gatekeeper, by Catherine Smith. Catherine Smith is a journalist and writer who counts serving as a book columnist for a newspaper among her credits. Much of her work has focused on FDR and the people around him. Catherine is the author of a previous book called A Necessary War, an oral history of World War II as told by veterans and civilians in Anderson County, South Carolina, where she lives. Catherine Smith, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Hi, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. So with all of your interest in FDR and his circle, how did Missy LeHand emerge as the book?
I wanted to have her job. She's the person in history I would most want to be. I just kept noticing her. She was always right there in the background, right beside FDR. And there just was never a lot of information about her. And I thought, gosh, what a fascinating life. I'd love to read her biography. And I did some digging around and found out no one had ever written one, so I decided to write it myself. And it was full of surprises.
Does that strike you as odd as it strikes me? I mean, after hearing about Missy LeHand, ever since I've really known that there ever was an FDR, it seems like she would have had a biography by now.
Yeah, there are several reasons for that. One was that Missy never kept a diary and never planned to write her own memoirs, unlike everybody else around FDR. They just started churning out the memoirs as soon as his pulse had stopped. And Missy died before he did. She died of a stroke when she was 47. And just kind of didn't leave much of a trail behind. So there was a lot of speculation about her that she was, in love with him. And so you kind of get this picture of a lovelorn secretary or possibly even his mistress. And it ignores her much more important role as his advisor and confidant and really, for all effects, the White House chief of staff after 1936.
And so important in so many ways, the anecdote that begins the book has Missy on the plane with FDR and his family heading to the 32 Democratic Convention for his acceptance speech. By that time, how long had she already worked for him?
She went to work for him in 1920, so she'd been there a dozen years. And it's often cited that she was the adult who spent the most time with FDR, I guess the person who spent the most time with FDR after his stroke. I mean, after his polio in 1921, she was with him when he established the polio rehab center at Warm Springs. Eleanor was not with him very much then, and Missy was really his companion all through that. Was very important to his rehabilitation and return to public life.
The stories aboard that plane heading to the 32 convention in Chicago when they hit turbulence and almost have flying typewriters and things like that.
But, cabin that was 18 feet long. Imagine.
Oh boy, I was trying to figure out that yesterday. 18 feet, trying to figure
out
what
a living room.
Yeah, small.
Small living room.
So what was she actually helping write? I mean, was she called upon to give some actual verbiage? I mean, to the speeches in addition to just typing it up.
Have a speech writing team, and FDR would just revise and revise and revise his speeches, but he had a team and he would have stenographers. Missy wasn't so much a stenographer, he used others for that, but there's a lot of her handwritten annotations on his speeches, and she was just part of the team. She understood how he expressed himself from working for him so long. She got to the point where she could write his letters for him and no one would know the difference because she knew how he spoke. So
did it become sort of like one brain, two bodies?
Kind of, yeah. They really had a very good understanding of each other.
So where did she come from? What qualifications did she have and what got her to FDR's inner circle?
She was from Massachusetts. She was from a working class suburb of Massachusetts called Somerville, of Boston called Somerville. It was it's actually a very nice place to live now, but it wasn't so much then. And she had studied secretarial science in high school, graduated in 1917, And a lot of times I'll read a book that mentions that despite the fact that she only had a high school education, well, in 1917, that was comparable to having a college education today. About a third of the population then had a high school education. Today, about a third has a college education. And even Eleanor Roosevelt didn't have a high school education. Her family had made her drop out before her final year of school to make her debut, and then she married FDR. So she had that education. She worked in various secretarial jobs, and through just a personal connection, she became the staff secretary of his FDR's vice presidential campaign in 1920.
Now, you mentioned that she functioned like a chief of staff in the White House even before the term existed, and I wonder if she wielded that authority with an even hand, or was she the kind of person who could put you in the deep freeze if you got on her bad side?
It was very much a team effort all around, and I've got an example of the team effort between her and FDR when William O. Douglas, who was chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, got in trouble with some of the major players on the New York Stock Exchange, and she called him up to say that FDR was at Hyde Park and wanted him to come up there and meet with some of these men. And she said, they want you to fire him. They want to fire you, so come on up. And so Douglas got there, and as soon as he got into the room, he just made some casual remark, and FDR just started this filibuster, just talking, smoking cigarettes, just talking this, talking that. No, it never got to the subject of why they were there. And then after half an hour, Missy walked in and said, "Time for your next appointment, Mr. President," made them all leave. You know, very much an orchestrated thing.
Mm-hmm.
She was very good, though, at bringing people into his orbit that she thought would be helpful. And I think the most important of these was a man named Tommy Corcoran. And sounds like we've got a break coming up, so we'll talk about Tommy the Cork.
You take a music cue very well, yes.
It's
sort of like the Oscars playing us off, but this is what happens when break time comes.
I'm not going to stop.
Thank you. Catherine Smith, okay. Our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is The Gatekeeper, about Missy LaHand, who was FDR's right-hand person for many years, all the way into the White House, and she actually ended up dying before he did by a few years. We'll get to talk more about Missy LaHand's life and relationship with FDR when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange. Your phone calls and emails welcome when we return in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Catherine Smith, a journalist and writer in South Carolina who's put together a book about FDR's right-hand woman. And it was Missy LaHand. Marguerite Missy LaHand was at the president's elbow through the first two terms in the White House, and long before that as well, working with him from 1920 forward, even through the days when he was stricken with polio. Not a lot known about Missy LaHand, because she was not, as Catherine has already pointed out, the kind of person who kept a diary and planned a memoir when her White House days were done. The book is called The Gatekeeper. Catherine Smith is here with us on The Exchange, and you can join in the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. A lot of people we talk to who are doing relatively recent, like within the 20th century history, have access to papers that were not previously available. Did you have any kind of windfall like that available to you, Catherine?
I did, and they came from the family of Missy LaHand. The only other person I'm aware of who's used any of these papers was Doris Kearns Goodwin in her book, No Ordinary Time, sorry, mm-hmm. Mind Freeze. And she had looked through some of the papers that belonged to one of Missy's great nieces, but there were two great nieces, cousins are very close. And when I contacted them about this book, they were very eager to help because they really wanted their great aunt's story told. And they had boxes and boxes and boxes of things, invitations, letters, fabulous pictures, scrapbooks, just newspaper clippings. So that really helped a whole lot in fleshing out Missy's story. The other thing that helped was the Yale Library has the papers of a man who Missy was involved with named William Christian Bullitt, and they included letters she had written to him when he was the ambassador to Russia and later to France. So that gave me Missy's voice and her thoughts, which really helped flesh her out quite a bit, too. I also found a medical file through a contact in the state of Georgia. It was in the Georgia archives, and it was her medical file from her whole adult life. Missy has sometimes been portrayed as someone who was emotionally fragile, and biographers have usually said, you know, she had a nervous breakdown because she was going to have to give FDR back up to public life, and she wanted him to herself or something like that. But it was all related to heart damage from her youth. She'd had rheumatic fever, and it permanently damaged her heart, and that's what killed her ultimately also.
And so she was referred to as a cardiac cripple in the terminology of the time.
She's someone who couldn't run. It would, you know, get very short of breath. One of the things that was interesting, she didn't graduate from high school till she was 20, which tells me she's probably spent a couple of years in bed. So that was one way that she and FDR had that emotional connection. She knew what it was like to be flat on her back.
Well, you know, neither one of them really helped their health very much, though. It sounds like they both smoked like chimneys.
Like chimneys. Everybody then did. And there were four people who came into the White House as FDR's secretariat, as they were called. They were the people that ran the West Wing. And only one survived FDR. And the other three all died of, you know, one died of TB, one died of lung disease and heart disease. Missy had a stroke. The other one lived to be 61, and then he had a heart attack on the golf course. So,
and then, of course, there's
Louis.
We haven't talked about Louis Howe yet, but that was FDR's confidant.
He was living in an oxygen tent in the White House.
Yikes, and was covered with ash for most of his life as he
lit
each cigarette off the previous one.
Wow. Yes. And they really smelled awful. They were called Sweet Caporal, so they were just these really smelly cigarettes. So,
I think I've smelled them. They smell like cigars, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of tobacco in there. So back to Missy, though. You mentioned graduated from high school at age 20. So what led to her career choice? I mean, she was thinking private secretary, and there was some mystique or romance built up about private secretaries at that time in history, it sounds like.
Well, it was a man's job. She was the first private secretary to a president in American history. But I think in her case, since she had the heart disease, there weren't a lot of career paths for women. She couldn't be a nurse because she had to be really careful about exposure to germs. She couldn't be a teacher for the same reason, because all of that would just cause her to have more and more heart problems. And she really even had to think hard about marriage, because pregnancy is very hard on someone whose heart has been damaged by rheumatic fever. I mean, life-threatening. So I think the secretary was about the only thing that was left to her. And unfortunately, she was very, very good at it. She was extremely organized and efficient and was a good supervisor. She had a staff of 50 working under her at the White House.
Well, the Missy LeHand is the subject of Catherine Smith's book, The Gatekeeper. Catherine's our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. How did she come into FDR's orbit then in 1920?
Well, working for his campaign, and mostly he was away. I don't know how much contact they really had. He got on a train and gave 1,000 speeches going all the way across the country. His running mate was, he was the running mate of James M. Cox. And they both just really got out there and stumped. And then they just got trounced by Warren G. Harding, who campaigned rather leisurely from the porch of his house in Ohio. But it was just a bad year for Democrats. It was a Republican year. They were sick of Wilson and all that. So they were just trounced. And after the campaign was over, Eleanor Roosevelt asked Missy to come up to Hyde Park and help clean up the leftover correspondence. So she went up there and spent a few weeks. And FDR liked her so much, they got along so well, that he asked her to come and work for him full-time as his private secretary. He was going into work on Wall Street in New York, and she agreed to come. So she'd been working for him for about 9 months when he went to his family's home on Campobello Island off the coast of Maine, and that's where he came down with polio and was paralyzed from the waist down.
So Missy LeHand, and we'll get into the depth of the relationship as we go through the broadcast, but came into FDR's life as his employee not long after His affair with Lucy Mercer Rutherford had almost blown up his marriage.
Yeah, it wasn't that much longer. I think the Lucy affair, and that's a lot of people look at me and say, oh, yeah, the secretary, wasn't she the one who?
Right.
But Lucy was the one who. She was Eleanor's social secretary when they were living in Washington. And between 1916 and 1918, it was a pretty long affair. He and Lucy Mercer fell in love, and it almost ended their marriage, but they decided to stay together and soldier on because various reasons, and he promised to end all contact with Lucy, but he never did. They were in contact until the end of his life.
She was with him when he died, wasn't she?
Mm-hmm. She was with him when he was stricken. They it was at Warm Springs, and they bundled her out of the little White House and put her in a car, and he died a few hours later. But, yeah.
So given that background, I mean, it sounds like Eleanor did actually trust Missy in ways that she wouldn't have trusted Lucy Mercer with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah, they had a really good relationship, and she was very useful to Eleanor because she enabled her to have her own life. She went off with FDR on his houseboat trips. He would go to the Florida Keys every winter and live on this old broken down houseboat with Missy, and lots of friends would come in and stay for a few weeks, and they'd fish and just have a jolly time. And Eleanor had five children to look after, and just had also carved out a really busy life for herself in Democratic women's politics. So when FDR was elected governor of New York in 1928, same thing. Eleanor really didn't want to be first lady. She had a part ownership in a school for girls in Manhattan, and she just kept doing all the stuff she was doing. She taught 3 days a week. She did a lot of speaking. She did inspection tours for FDR around the state of New York, and she could always count on Missy to be her backup at the governor's mansion, you know, presiding over dinners and teas and supervising the staff and ordering groceries and all the things that needed to be done. So it was a useful relationship for all three adults. And Eleanor was quite fond of Missy. The letters between them are very affectionate, and she did a lot of really kind things for Missy over the years.
In fact, Missy was close enough to the family that I didn't realize she got her name from the kids.
Yeah. They had trouble saying Miss LaHand, and it just kind of turned into Missy LaHand, and they started calling her Missy. But she had other nicknames. Some people called her Peg. Her family called her Marg.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about Missy LaHand, Marguerite LaHand, who is the subject of Catherine Smith's book, The Gatekeeper. Missy LaHand, the longtime personal secretary to FDR during his days in the White House and for a dozen years before he even got elected. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about her life and her life in relation to his as well. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's come back to the 20s. So FDR had run as the vice presidential candidate and had lost with James Cox to the Harding Coolidge ticket in 1920. After that, he was stricken with polio. So much was kept from the public, certainly in the early days. And how long before even Missy got the true story?
In the very early days, she had written a letter to FDR on vacation asking for a raise. And she got a letter back from Eleanor saying that the president had had a severe chill and was unable to respond, but she felt sure that he would, you know, be open to the idea. And I think she probably found out from Louis Howe in the weeks that followed just how serious it was. So it was, you know, they were all very optimistic, and the doctor said, oh, yes, he'll definitely walk again and all that. And he was optimistic. He tried everything to be able to walk again, all kinds of treatments, conventional and unconventional, but really nothing was going to work. You know, it's just kind of like his body was just, it was dealing with what was left after a shipwreck pretty much. The really marvelous thing that FDR did, and I think even if he had never become president, it would be just a huge legacy, is he established the rehab center in Warm Springs, Georgia for polios, and then that followed up with the founding of the National Foundation for Infantile Paralysis, which we know better as the March of Dimes, and just raised millions and millions of dollars for polio treatment and research, and found the cure, found the vaccine. It's the only charity in history that found the disease for the cure for the disease it was fighting.
The use of the term polios comes from that time. Basically, when you got stricken with the disease, was that the reference to you then?
They called you a polio, yeah. Mm. And it wasn't a derogatory term. That's just what they call themselves. They're all these funny little plays and poems and songs that they wrote for shows they put on in Warm Springs, and they would, you know, make jokes about the polios.
The connection to the March of Dimes is interesting. Just the other day when we were looking for a picture to use on the website to set up who Missy LeHand was, there's this mm-hmm. great picture of her in this huge stack of letters with people sending in dimes. But she obscures her face, though, because she's holding the dime up to the camera right in front of her face.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. When we look at all the brouhaha over the Clinton Foundation, the same kind of things were said about the March of Dimes and the Warm Springs Foundation, that, oh, the Roosevelts are just lining their pockets with the money, or else they're giving political favors to big supporters of the March of Dimes. These same language. And then you have this just pile of envelopes, just hundreds of thousands of letters that poured into the White House. Now imagine, it was the equivalent of $250,000 in cash that came flooding the White House.
Wow.
What that would happen today, you know, White House staff sorting this stuff out. But it found the cure, and that's, of course, why FDR is on the dime. It was the Congress restruck the dime the year after he died. That's why he's still there today.
So in the period when he was beginning to recover as well as he did, you notice a subtle change in his correspondence. She stopped calling him Mr. Roosevelt at some point.
Yeah, she called him FD and always did, even in the White House. You know, she was in a meeting of some sort or another where you have to keep up appearances. It's always Mr. President, but she called him FD, and really no one else did.
I noticed, too, that it sometimes got abbreviated to EFFDEE.
Yeah, FD. That was the phonetical spelling.
In addition to the fact that she was often by his side, particularly at Warm Springs, I mean, how much did she figure in some of the things that directly involved with his health, like his physical therapy?
Well, certainly she wasn't a physical therapist, but the funny thing is when they first started having the polios just started showing up at Warm Springs because of newspaper articles about what he was trying to do there, they had no medical staff. So it was just, you know, FDR styled himself as Dr. Roosevelt, and she became Nurse LeHand, and they just worked with the patients in the warm water pools there and helped them swim about and exercise. And then afterwards, you know, what they did, as much as anything else, is impart hope to these folks who just didn't have a whole lot of hope. They'd been locked away in back rooms of their homes and felt useless, and they just created this great atmosphere of fun and camaraderie, and people left feeling better. Eventually, though, it became a tremendous orthopedic center. They did a lot of orthopedic surgery and other kinds of therapy, and it was the place to go in the United States if you had polio for decades.
We're talking to Catherine Smith about her book about Missy LeHand, the private secretary to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The book is called The Gatekeeper. You mentioned already the boat trips to Florida that they took in the wintertime. These sound rather Hemingway-esque at times. Give us a sense of what was going on here.
I recently got a book that's coming out this fall. Someone has transcribed the logbooks of the Laruku. That was the name of the boat, which was described as looking like a floating tenement. And they just fished constantly. They were catching their supper every day. And Missy loved to fish. Both she and FDR just was a lifelong pursuit. And they just had a great time. But they had just constant engine trouble. The boat was very old, and so every day some part of one of the motors was falling off, or this was falling off, or they got stuck on a sandbar, and just, you know, constant problems like that. Missy also said that FDR was masking a lot of depression at that time. I think he was kind of adrift. That's what I call that chapter. He was sort of aimless and just looking for, you know, what's going to happen to me. Can I come back into a world of politics if I can't walk? So when they went to Warm Springs in 1924, that was really the beginning of his return. He created something from nothing there, and it just gave him a new cause he believed in. He was really almost drafted. He was drafted into running for governor of New York in 1928. No one thought he'd win, and he did.
Hmm. So to come back to the boat trips for just a second, because this is a place I've been before, reading about what Elliot Roosevelt, FDR's son, wrote about coming in and seeing Missy sitting on FDR's lap. Where have things gone in terms of being able to explore that relationship and understand just how physical it might have been?
Well, you know, I didn't have access to this transcript of the LaRocco diaries, and actually FDR's handwriting is so atrocious, I just gave up trying to read it before that. They were, they had so much company on the boat. It was just really almost constant. They may have a few days when it was just the two of them, but they had a four-member staff also, so it wasn't like they were just there. And everybody was in their pajamas and nightgowns, and I've got, this is a rather really cool thing, is Missy's family had her home movies from the 30s, the 20s and 30s, and I've gotten to watch those, and there was just a lot of that kind of thing. You know, people would be sitting in each other's laps at picnics, and I don't know, Elliot was the only one of FDR's children who claimed that Missy and FDR had a sexual relationship. Unfortunately, he was the one who wrote the most also, so not only did he write the book saying that, but then he hired a ghostwriter to write the Eleanor Roosevelt mystery series for him, and he put that kind of winking nod to, you know, that into every one of those books.
But the other four children of FDR said
they disavowed Elliot's book. And, in fact, James Roosevelt, who knew Missy much better than Elliot, said that that it wasn't true.
Okay.
We just don't know, really.
Truly. Much more to talk about Missy LaHand, Marguerite LaHand, who was at the right hand of President Roosevelt for several years, almost two full decades. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Catherine Smith about her book, The Gatekeeper, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Catherine Smith, journalist and writer from Anderson County, South Carolina. She's written a book about Missy LaHand. Marguerite LaHand was her true name, who was the personal secretary to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt through most of his first two terms in the White House, before she was stricken by a stroke late in her life and died actually at age 47 before FDR did. Very important woman to FDR, not ever been the subject of a biography apparently before now. You can join us as we talk about Missy LaHand's life, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The initial trips to Warm Springs in 1924, which wasn't even called Warm Springs at the time, it turns out it was
Bullockville,
right.
An unlovely name.
Oddly enough, though, there was a family relationship to Eleanor?
There was some, her grandmother was a Bullock from, I think, Roswell, some other part of Georgia, so there might have been a relationship there, but Eleanor never took to Georgia.
All right, there's something about the way that you write about the things that FDR and Missy saw when they arrived in Georgia in 1924 that gave them a sense of what American poverty could be, and maybe this informed some of his later efforts in the New Deal.
Yeah. Well, Missy certainly knew what it was like to struggle. Her family, she always said, wasn't poor, but they worked hard for everything they had. Her father was a gardener. But, it must have been just like arriving at a third world village, because the nearest paved road was 10 miles away. They didn't have much electricity, running water, you know, the outhouses, the plowing was done by mules. It was, Georgia was mired in a agricultural depression way before the Great Depression began. So they saw some real eye-opening sights there. FDR, I think, got a lot of his ideas for the New Deal from there about the banking system and agricultural policies. Certainly rural electrification was something that was inspired by Warm Springs, because he got his first power bill, and it was many times higher than the one he was paying in New York, and it just astounded him. So, and then just also seeing how hard people's lives were. down there in rural Georgia.
Sure. Missy, we've talked about the fact that she had rheumatic fever as a teen, and so had been, her heart was essentially crippled or at least damaged by the rheumatic fever. She had a health flare-up in 1927, and I think this is the incident that leads people to talk in terms of her having a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, and they kind of say, oh, you know, 1927, FDR had sold the LaRocco, or I think that LaRocco was destroyed by a hurricane, or anyway, they found some way to tie that event. But it was definitely heart trouble. She was swimming in the pool and started suffering from rapid heartbeat atrial fibrillation. And they treated it then, as they do now, with digitalis. And Missy had a toxic reaction to the digitalis. It's just a documented reaction called digitalis delirium. And she just kind of went off her head. So it's not surprising that people said, oh, yes, she had a nervous breakdown. But it took a while to get her over it. She had to go back to New York to the hospital up there because there was really no appropriate place to care for her in Warm Springs. And but she recovered and, you know, got back to normal. But, you know, she had heart spells pretty regularly through her time with them, and they all knew that. They all talked about her fragile health, but it didn't stop her from working her to death.
No doubt. How well did the inner circle, the Cufflinks gang, function without Missy there?
Well, the Cufflinks gang was, you mean after she died? Or?
Well, no, just in her absence for that episode in 27.
Well, the Cufflinks gang was a group of people who had worked with FDR on his 1920 election, and it was just he would kind of add to the gang over the years as people joined his political bandwagon. It's hard to know. That's probably an area where I have less documentation those years in Warm Springs. So FDR was traveling a back and forth a lot between New York and Georgia then, so he did what he did. When he ran for governor in 1928, Missy had had another spell, and he brought in a young woman named Grace Tully to be his campaign secretary, and she joined the staff permanently and became Missy's closest friend and assistant, and eventually succeeded her as FDR's private secretary.
Before the White House and before even in the governor's office, was it a pretty even-handed sort of distribution of duties around the inner circle that was around FDR?
It was kind of interesting. Now, Louis Howe was always the political guru, and we talked about what a strange-looking little man he was. He was about 5 feet tall, smoked those really smelly cigarettes, and just had ashes all over him all the time. But he was the political guru, just a genius, really. FDR would have someone at the governor's office in New York that he had a secretary there whose main job was just to help him get around because he was a strapping young man. Then Missy would be working in the governor's mansion, and FDR probably did about half of his work there, especially having people in the evening in to talk about policy and that kind of stuff. It's hard to say what was evenly distributed. I've heard one writer say that Louis Howe handled politics, Steve Early the press, Marvin McIntyre the appointments, and Missy did everything else. So, I mean, she even had power of attorney over FDR's business concerns.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Very busy lady.
So once they got through the governor's office and into the White House just 4 years later, was she truly the first woman to serve as a secretary to the president?
Yeah. Yeah, there always been men before.
Wow.
Yeah.
Obviously she's going to have to bark a few orders at a few people, or at least suggest they do things. And any record of how men took to her?
You know, everyone seemed to have really liked Missy. She wasn't a barker. She was... People just thought she was just a really charming and nice person. She was very self-effacing. And whenever she was giving an interview, she said, oh, no, I never talked to the president about politics or anything personal, which was ridiculous. Everyone knew differently. I mentioned Tommy the Cork early in our chat.
Tommy Corcoran,
yeah. Love to talk about Tommy.
Sure.
He became FDR's lobbyist and, you know, pushed through a lot of the New Deal legislation, including the Social Security Act. But he was brought in by Missy. He was an Irish Catholic like her, and he was recommended by her friend Felix Frankfurter, who had been his professor at Harvard Law. And there were so many young lawyers like Tommy around the Capitol, they were called Frankfurter's Happy Hot Dogs. So, and she just, you know, was able to size him up and see that he would do FDR a lot of good, and he did. He was just a very, very useful man. But several times there were men who thought that Eleanor Roosevelt was too pushy would like Missy because she was just more self-effacing. She would get things done, but in a less aggressive manner.
Were the White House hours sort of like they were in the Clinton White House, or what seems like every White House in recent years, that everybody seemed to be there 16, 18 hours a day?
Well, Missy was there 24 hours a day because she lived upstairs. She lived had a suite on the third floor, and she never went home. That was her home. So she was literally there all the time. There's one really outstanding example of how she could be on call, and that was on September 1st, 1939, nobody could wake the president up without her permission. So a phone call came in that Hitler had invaded Poland, and they wanted to know, is it okay to wake up the president? So she said, of course, and then she ran downstairs to his bedroom, and they sat up there just getting that horrible, horrible news that the incident that sparked World War II had begun.
So was she also then the one who well, actually, with the timing might not have been right for her to deliver the news about Pearl Harbor?
No, and when Pearl Harbor happened, she had already had her stroke and was actually at Warm Springs trying to recover from that. So Grace Tully had taken over as secretary by then, and Grace was the one who helped draft that speech about Day of Infamy.
So Missy's stroke was in 1940, is that right?
41.
Okay.
1941, and Pearl Harbor was December 1941. She was really upset when it happened, and she called the White House and tried to speak to FDR, which was her stroke damage was mostly to her voice, so she had some paralysis also, and just couldn't speak well, so she couldn't get through to him, and was just very, very depressed about not being there to help.
Had she been moved out of the White House once she was stricken?
She went back to the White House in the spring of 1942, and they thought that would be good for her emotionally and mentally because she was very depressed, and it just turned out to be a really bad situation. She was smoking in bed one day, set her bed on fire, and when she got recovered from the burns, they moved her back home. FDR was horribly afraid of fire, as you can imagine. It was something that went back to his childhood, but being a paralyzed man, he just, was terrified of fire, and they just couldn't have a fire hazard in the White House.
What, I'm just trying to figure out whether she really had a life outside of the White House. I mean, she'd been there since the first quarter of 1933 then.
She had a boyfriend. He was a very dashing and debonair man named William Christian Bullitt, and he was the first ambassador to the Soviet Union and then to France. So it was a long-distance relationship, though. He would come home for, 6 weeks or 2 months at a time, squire around town and buy her flowers and jewelry and all that kind of thing. And had the correspondence and phone talks when he was away. But I think that Missy really preferred it that way. When he came back to the States after Hitler took over France, she broke it off very quickly, and it was obvious the reason is he just wanted too much of her time. So,
any relation to the Bullets of Seattle?
I don't think so.
Okay.
B-U-L-L-I-T-T. He was from Philadelphia.
Okay, yeah. Dorothy Stinson Bullitt and her family owned a couple of major broadcasting stations in Portland and Seattle for a long time, the whole King chain. Okay, just a side question there.
I hadn't known that before.
In all the research you did, and first of all, let me ask you how long that took.
I started in April of 2013. Mm-hmm. So turned the book in last summer, and it takes about a year to get a book edited and produced and ready to market.
Mm-hmm. So good 2 years, it sounds like.
More than two.
Digging through the stuff. What if anything, leaped out at you as perhaps the most surprising thing that you'd ever hadn't known about Missy LaHand?
Well, everything. I guess that she had the really intense relationship with William Christian Bullitt. I went into it with kind of a romantic notion that she was the great love of Roosevelt's life and just came away with a very different opinion. I think she adored him, but I think that he adored her, but in a different kind of way. And an awful lot of the people who worked for FDR adored him. He just was somebody who was very charismatic. People would just work themselves to death for him. It was said that Tommy Corcoran would do anything for FDR, including commit murder. So that was how I came away, that she was, that her import was as her value as an advisor and a facilitator and a power behind the throne, much more than, you know, maybe his girlfriend.
How big a blow to him to not have her around anymore? I mean, obviously this is a critical time in history.
Very
World
much
War II
so.
Already underway.
Yeah, some of the things that were said, Harold Ickes, who was the Secretary of the Interior, said it was the biggest blow he had had since his inauguration. And Sam Rosamond, who was one of his speech writers, likened it to losing a battle during World War II. Just a terrible blow. Some people even thought that if she had stayed around, that FDR might have lived longer because she would have helped him husband his strength and energy, though that's hard to know. He was in really bad health. And I think as soon as 1940, she knew that his health was very, very compromised.
Well, yeah, true. And he ran for president in 1944, knowing he had congestive heart failure. And,
yeah, that's one of the really poignant things is Missy saw a newsreel at a movie in July 31st, 1944, and she hadn't seen pictures, movie reel pictures of FDR in a while, and she was so shocked by how bad he looked that she went home and had a stroke, and that's what killed her.
Wow. She didn't have children, didn't have a husband. Where was she buried? Who took care of her in her closing days?
Well, she had a really loving family. She had a sister, a brother. She had two nieces that she just adored, and they cared for her. But FDR paid all her medical bills. He paid for her to have a nurse, a private duty nurse. And she was buried at Mount Auburn Cemetery, a really beautiful cemetery in Cambridge. And the Roosevelt family paid for the funeral. They paid for her marker, which says she was utterly selfless in her devotion to duty, an FDR quote. And to this day, the Roosevelt family pays for the upkeep of Missy LeHand's grave.
Wow, that's quite a life she had, and has been generally in the shadows up until now.
Yeah, she was a marvelous person.
It sounds like this was a labor of love for you, ultimately.
It was.
Well, thanks so much for sharing it with us and letting us talk to you about The Gatekeeper today. Catherine Smith, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks again.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
All right,
bye.
Take care.